So I'd like to start out by thanking again Manuel and Peter, not just for inviting me, but for organizing and running a really spectacular conference. I don't know that I've ever been to one as large as this, which has run as smoothly as this has. And I thought the quality of the sessions has been wonderful. So thank you. Thank you very much. Okay. So I've taken the topics of the conference, Mind and Nature, as an opportunity to reflect on Nietzsche's attacks on dualism. Mind and nature are, after all, two of the familiar terms in which the traditional dualism has been stated. And I think every reader of Nietzsche quickly sees that he's a vigorous opponent of such dualism, and that he insists to the contrary that mind be understood as a part of nature. So he embraces some version of monism. This is most vividly expressed in a famous passage from Zarathustra. But the awakened one, the one who knows, says, "Body am I through and through, and nothing besides, and soul is merely a word for something about the body." By the way, there's a handout out there which has a kind of outline of the talk with some of the quotations. I want to show, though, that the issue is much more complex, and I hope more interesting than it might at first seem. I want to show that on the one hand, Nietzsche's attack on dualism carries him very far, much further than we initially expect. It carries him, indeed, to a radical monism that is, however, very hard to square with his other strong commitments. And so Nietzsche is repeatedly pulled back from this monism to dualist views at seeming odds with it. This opens up a great tension, an apparent contradiction in his thinking, and poses the question what philosophical means he has for addressing it. This tension is aligned with certain others in his thought, in particular with that arising from his perspectivism. I think examining this issue over monism versus dualism throws helpful light on some of these other basic issues as well. And let me just insert quickly here, this is a new topic for me. This is a topic on which my thinking has, in many ways, not quite crystallized, and so I hope you'll bear with me for a certain, maybe shifting and uncertain character in some of what I have to say. Now, as I said, I think our first reaction is that he rejects dualism altogether. Let me start with a sketch of some pretty familiar elements of this critique of dualism and of the view Nietzsche offers in its place. Nietzsche doesn't especially identify this dualism with Descartes, but he clearly has in focus, I think, a view we ourselves call Cartesian, distinguishing immaterial mind, a thinking thing, from body defined as entirely as extended. Thinking and extension, matter and mind, are of such utterly different ontological categories that they support completely different sets of properties. It's nonsense to suppose that mind could have a weight or a shape, or that matter could have feelings or views. Nietzsche's attack runs mainly against the mind side of this dualism, of course. So Antichrist 14 says that Descartes boldly viewed animals as machines, but we go further and view humans as such too. We see consciousness as a symptom of, quote, the relative imperfection of the organism. Pure spirit is a pure stupidity. When we discount the nervous system and the senses, the mortal shroud, we miscount nothing more. But really, I think, Nietzsche rejects both sides of the duality. There's no merely material body any more than there's an incorporeal mind. If he absorbs mind into body, it is into a body with very different properties than Descartes' matter. Indeed, Nietzsche argues that Cartesian extension is something we interpret into the world. It's not real, much less essential. Instead, he thinks of body as essentially a capacity, a dunamis. Moreover, he crucially thinks of this capacity as intentional, in the sense that it means and aims at things. So body, the one substance there is, has as its most important properties not extension or weight or shape, but intendings that Descartes would have restricted to mind. Thus Nietzsche promotes, against that dualism of mind and nature, an ontological monism. Ultimately, there is only one kind of entity, one basic way of being an entity. Everything is of the same sort, I'll call this being monism. Nietzsche associates this monism and many of the related views we'll examine with Heraclitus. So from Philosophy and the Tragic Age of the Greeks, Nietzsche says that Heraclitus, quote, denied the duality of totally diverse worlds, a position which Anaximander had been compelled to assume. He no longer distinguished a physical world from a metaphysical one. I'll point out these connections at various points, these connections to Heraclitus at various points as we go. So there is one kind of entity, and for it Nietzsche has one term he overwhelmingly prefers, life. This is his crucial notion, I think, much more important to him than nature, and also more basic than will to power, which is offered as an hypothesis about life. Accordingly, we can understand life as capacities that aim or mean. Everything that is, according to Nietzsche, is such a directedness. However, we also know that values are much more important to Nietzsche than facts, even more important than very basic ontological facts. So more important than his attack on ontological dualism is a parallel campaign he fights against valuative dualism. And this is going to be the real focus of my talk. Indeed, I think his main objection to being dualism is its service as a prop for value dualism. People have needed to believe that being is dual in support of their belief that values are dual. This is why Nietzsche cares about Cartesian dualism so much. It's associated with a sickness in our values. And this sickness is more directly expressed in our tendency towards a value dualism, our faith in opposite values. This attack on value dualism plays a major role in his thought. It's not too much to say, I suggest, that this rejection is his main reply to morality, his main motive for replacing moral with aesthetic values. Or to put it another way, it's his main motive for replacing a morality of good versus evil with values of good versus bad. This attack on opposite values has been widely noticed, but it may be more controversial to claim that Nietzsche intends to replace it with a monism about values. Now notice I mean this differently than the common, I don't know if there is a common use of a value monism, but the use that I've been able to find is a view that claims that all intrinsic value lies in a single property, for example, happiness. I mean something more radical and I think difficult than that view. I mean instead the claim that everything has the same kind of value, or indeed, this may be going a little too far, everything has the same value. And for Nietzsche, that value is good. His value monism, I suggest, is that everything is good. So values aren't discrepant kinds. They aren't opposite, or indeed ultimately different from one another. Now initially this doesn't seem like an appealing or even a coherent position, nor something that we might recognize in Nietzsche. Yet I think it's one of the views that he holds dearest. It finds expression in many places in different degrees of completeness. And I want now to remind you of this value monism's ultimate form, where it's expressed in several of his most famous ideas. All of them are entangled with one another, as these quotes will show. These views are saying yes, eternal return, amor fati, and the Dionysian. So first, Nietzsche most prides himself as someone who says yes. He says yes to everything, even what seems most unsatisfactory in or about life, both his own life and life in general. He commends or indeed preaches this attitude to us. This is Zarathustra's identity, to be the ultimate yes-sayer, quote, the opposite of a no-saying spirit. That's from Ecce Homo. And Nietzsche often presents himself so. In Gay Science 276, he presents this as his New Year's ambition, the New Year's resolution. I want to learn more and more how to see what is necessary in things as what is beautiful in them. Thus I will be one of those who make things beautiful. And then there's a sentence about amor fati. I do not want to accuse. I do not even want to accuse the accusers. Let looking away be my only negation. And all in all and on the whole, someday I want only to be a yes-sayer. Now, I agree with Bernard in his recent book on the importance of this. Bernard says that, quote, Nietzsche regards the affirmation of life as his defining philosophical achievement. And so I take the paper to explore, as it were, at least one radical form that this affirmation of life takes. Second set of passages concern, of course, the thought of eternal return. That's entangled with this saying, yes. So Ecce Homo, I won't give the full reference, introduces eternal return as the highest possible formula of affirmation. One's ability to embrace eternal return is telling, precisely because it shows that one can say yes to everything, even the most repellent features of life. So the thought of eternal return serves Zarathustra as, quote, one more reason for himself to be the eternal yes to all things, the incredible, boundless yes saying, amen saying. Third set of passages concern amor fati. One example, again from Ecce Homo, quote, my formula for greatness in a human being is amor fati, that one wants nothing to be different, not forward, not backward, not in all eternity, not merely bear what is necessary, but love it. And then fourthly, the Dionysian also, of course, involves this yes saying. Passage from Will to Power 1041, quote, a Dionysian affirmation of the world as it is, without subtraction, exception, or selection, the highest state a philosopher can attain, to stand in a Dionysian relationship to existence, my formula for this is amor fati. And then in Will to Power 1052, note says that in the Dionysian state, quote, being is counted as holy enough to justify even a monstrous amount of suffering. Now, it might be doubted, though, that this saying yes, even saying yes to, quote, everything, really involves a value monism, that is, saying that each thing is good. So mightn't Nietzsche's point instead be that the sum or totality of life is good, not that every single instance of it is? So might his idea be that there are a lot of bad things in the totality, but that they're outweighed by the good things? So the affirmation, as it were, applies to the totality, but is not distributed down to each member, all of the individual entities. In this case, the affirmation would be only a yes to the sum. And often it seems that that's what Nietzsche is indeed saying. It seems that he's judging the aggregate and that he's not inclined in some passages to say that the weak or the sick or the herd-like, for example, are good. But I'm going to argue that Nietzsche means, at least at these moments when he thinks ultimate thoughts about eternal return and so on, that we must say yes to each thing. That is, we have to recognize each thing as good. So the affirmation, I'm going to say, is also at least yes to each. We've seen that willing eternal return requires saying yes to even the most repellent parts or aspects of life. The drama of Zarathustra, in fact, hinges on the difficulty of this last step, to will the recurrence of even the most loathsome. Zarathustra remarks how it is easy to turn eternal return into a lyre song, Gertie song, it's also translated, depicting the cyclical character of everything beautifully. What's hard is to think this thought with respect to what one dislikes the most. In Zarathustra's case, the small man, to the tawdry in, I think, himself and in others. The challenge is not just to say yes to a world that contains this, I suggest, but to say yes to this particular detested thing itself. Also notice in this regard how Ecce Homo develops the indispensability of the small and the sick in Nietzsche himself. He loves even this about himself. This distribution of intrinsic value down to every individual bit of life is buttressed by Nietzsche's metaphysical claim that everything is essential. Nothing in the world and all its history could be different without everything being different. Inasmuch as everything is essential, to say yes to anything requires saying yes to everything. This is a passage from Zarathustra. Did you ever say yes to a single joy? Oh, my friends, then you said yes to all woe as well. All things are chained together, entwined in love. If you ever wanted one time, a second time, if you ever said, you please me, happiness, quick moment, then you wanted it all back. Nevertheless, I think, even this isn't as strong as Nietzsche sometimes makes the point, for it still allows that many things could be good only instrumentally, only because they are necessary for other things that are good. It allows that although we say yes to each thing, we say yes to some of these things only because they're a means to, necessary for, other things that are intrinsically good. But I claim, Nietzsche, at least sometimes, wants the point to be that they are also good intrinsically, that is, good in their own right or for themselves. So I suggest the affirmation, at least sometimes, is even stronger. It's a yes to each for itself. So it's not enough to value the weak for the use they serve to the strong or to the economy of the whole. We must somehow value weakness for itself. Now, as we'll see, one main argument he makes is that weakness, for example, is not just causally necessary for certain goods, but essential or logically necessary in such a way that it is a constituent or element of those goods. Now, notice that even that still leaves these things' goodness dependent on an argument from the goodness of the more encompassing things. And I don't think that Nietzsche is always content even with that. It's not clear that weakness would be intrinsically good in this case, where it's good as an element in a larger situation. So look at Will to Power 293. Nothing that happened at all can be in itself reprehensible, for one should not want to eliminate it, for everything is so bound up with everything else that to want to exclude something means to exclude everything. A reprehensible action means a reprehended world. And sometimes the point is that everything, at least everything alive, is in and by itself holy, and in some sense of equal value. As Zarathustra's animals put it, the center is everywhere. That seems to me to articulate the idea that everything is of equal value. Now these ideas bring Nietzsche into harmony with certain mysticisms and pantheisms. Heraclitus' passage, the God, day, night, winter, summer, war, peace, satiety, hunger. And Philosophy of the Tragic Age of the Greeks says about Heraclitus, quote, before the God's fire gaze, not a drop of injustice remains in the world poured all around him. And for Nietzsche, too, the view is associated with the deification of all life. It's not just good, but holy. Will to Power 1005 says that Schopenhauer, quote, did not understand how to deify the will. He failed to grasp that there can be an infinite variety of ways of being different, even of being God. Will to Power 1050 says that the Dionysian means, quote, the great pantheistic sharing of joy and sorrow that sanctifies and calls good even the most terrible and questionable qualities of life. And Will to Power 1052 says that the Dionysian is the religious affirmation of life, life whole and not denied or in part. Now, one way to put the puzzle that I'm eventually going to come back to is mysticisms commonly promote a non-willing or selflessness. So how can this value monism that I'm attributing to Nietzsche be consistent in Nietzsche with the promotion of willing and selfishness? Okay, now, as mysticisms must be, this is both very hard to spell out and very hard to adhere to. It's difficult to state this value monism in a way that seems coherent. It seems to issue in various contradictions. Does saying that everything is good, and so denying opposite values, mean that nothing is bad? Or if we say that some things are bad, how is this consistent with also saying yes to them? And don't values need to come with opposites? To say that X is good requires some supposing that something else is, by contrast, bad, it seems. What sense can there be in saying that everything is good? It seems that Nietzsche must be pulled to to a value dualism by the very need to make judgments pro and con. This difficulty is compounded if we take the view to be that everything is not just good, but equally good. The center is everywhere. For in this case, not only can't we distinguish some as good and others as bad, but we can't even make distinctions among the good. We can't rank the good. We can't make up for the loss of the contrast term bad by shifting to the idea less good. This makes it harder to see how the all-affirming stance is consistent with valuing at all, since valuing, it seems, involves making distinctions. Moreover, further complication, some bits of life are themselves cases of saying no. So when we say yes to everything, it seems we are also saying yes to saying no. This calls into question in what sense Nietzsche can be commending to us saying yes rather than saying no. Isn't he in effect saying yes to saying yes, but saying no to saying no, hence not universally affirming after all? Okay, so there are these various puzzles, I think, that are wrapped up in this idea. Moreover, Nietzsche will be the first to say that living requires not just saying yes, but also saying no. Sometimes he seems to make this very point in reply to the monist ideas that we've just looked at. So will to power 333, to desire that something should be different from what it is means to desire that everything should be different. It involves a condemnatory critique of the whole. But life itself is such a desire, he says. So life involves desiring, though desiring is itself a wanting to be other, that is, strictly, a rejecting of the whole. Life indeed requires us not just to say no, but even to hate and fight against some things, as Nietzsche himself obviously did, and so to say a very emphatic and vehement no. Indeed, when the Dionysian stance loves destruction, it loves the most violently practical way of saying no. So how can that value monism be livable or even coherent? Once Nietzsche makes value monism require so very much, as he does in those thoughts about universal affirmation, he sets a lower standard for a value dualism, which it's very difficult then for him to avoid falling into. Now, Nietzsche himself is well aware of the apparent discrepancy between his claimed identity as the ultimate yes-sayer and his constant devastating attacks and critiques. Ecce homo, quote, I obey my Dionysian nature, which does not know how to separate doing no from saying yes. Nietzsche, more acutely and aggressively than any of us, wants to bring out valuative differences and distinctions, ways that some things fail and fall short of ways they might and should be. Indeed, one of these, as noted, is his very attack on value dualism. But this makes him prone to certain value dualisms after all. Moreover, the need to say no so emphatically, overriding or suspending the monism in his values, leads Nietzsche to temper it, I suggest, in his ontology as well. He's pulled towards a bifurcation of organisms or persons or drives into two opposite kinds, reflecting their sharply different intrinsic value. Everything is life, indeed, but life comes in two antithetical kinds, one of which has lost part of what is essential to life. It not only takes a position against life, it's anti-life, it falls away from the full nature of life. And Nietzsche especially tends to view mind or reason in particular in this way. So then he reproduces, started out with the seeming dualism of mind and nature. What I'm suggesting now is that he replaces, he as it were repeats this dualism in some of his thoughts in the valuative realm. He reproduces a version of the mind-nature dualism after all by making mind a principle contrary to life. So he bifurcates into active, reactive, healthy, sick, weak, strong, as if they are distinct kinds of persons or organisms. And of course, we find this tendency of beaches to bifurcate in many other places as well, you know, beginning with the Apollonian-Dionysian distinction, also in the master-slave distinction, and so on. In many cases, in many such cases, he uses bifurcation to express a kind of fervor or even fury that's comparable to the moral denunciations he criticizes. This dualist tendency is most active where Nietzsche offers his values most shrilly, which is in The Antichrist. I have a long quote I think I won't read, but it's from Antichrist 18, condemning the Christian idea of God. The problem then is to explain how Nietzsche can be at once the person who says yes to life in general, and Nietzsche particular, and the one who is relentlessly and harshly negative in most of his appraisals, at once a value monist and a value dualist. Now, I think a first reaction to my sketch of this problem is that his real allegiance is to neither monism nor dualism, and that we should really see him as a pluralist. With respect to being, or what is, we remark his emphasis on the great diversity of different kinds of life and persons and social and historical settings. Similarly, with respect to values, Nietzsche thinks that the value of people comes in a great hierarchy of degrees, all the steps of the ladder he so often imagines. However, I think these pluralisms about being and value are really consistent with his monisms here. The great diversity of forms of life are, after all forms of life, the one fundamental kind of thing there is. And similarly, I'll try to show, for the great hierarchy or ladder of values, they are all ways of having the goodness that belongs to life. So the pluralism by itself, I think, doesn't pose a threat to my account of Nietzsche's monism. However, the pluralism may be associated with another doctrine that raises greater problems, and this is Nietzsche's so-called perspectivism. Sometimes it seems he gives authority concerning being, concerning values, to all, or at least to a great plurality of perspectives. He makes being and value perspectival, it seems. We might take him to exemplify this perspectivism in his own freewheeling way of articulating a great scatter of perspectives all by himself. So he sometimes expresses monist sentiments, other times dualist, other times pluralist. But the last, the suggestion may be, is also the view, the pluralist, is also the view that he holds at the meta level. And so there's a kind of perspectival pluralism which embeds monism and dualism within it. Now, for these and other reasons, it may well seem that there isn't a serious question here as to whether Nietzsche is a monist or a dualist. But I want to persuade you that these are, indeed, two powerful tendencies or inclinations in him, one or the other of which finds expression in most of his most famous views. Okay, I'm now going to skip a section in which I come back to the topic of the conference and discuss the being monism. Critique of a dualism of mind and nature. And I'm going to focus now on one famous way that Nietzsche states his value monism, as an attack on opposite values. The most prominent locus for this is his critique of metaphysics in Beyond Good and Evil 2. This is a famous passage. Quote, "The fundamental faith of the metaphysicians is the faith in opposite values." And Beyond Good and Evil 2 goes on to say that, quote, "one may doubt first whether there are any opposites at all, quote, moreover, it's possible that, quote, what constitutes the value of these good and revered things is precisely that they are insidiously tied to and involved with these wicked, seemingly opposite things, maybe even one with them in essence." This line of thought is developed in many other places, both later in Beyond Good and Evil and elsewhere. So Beyond Good and Evil 47, quote, "the dominion of morals, it believed in opposite moral values and saw, read, interpreted these opposites into the text and the facts." Zarathustra, the historical Zarathustra in Nietzsche's conception, was the inventor of the good-evil opposition, of the value dualism. And so the Spoke Zarathustra is the story of his recantation of that dualism. This is a point that we find Nietzsche making from very early on. I have a passage from Human All Too Human, the very first section of it, which I'm going to skip over. I think it's clear that this rejection of opposite values is part of the complaint against the values of good versus evil, the kind of valuing he often calls just slave morality, and sometimes just morality. I think it's clear this rejection of opposite values, that part of his criticism of these values is directed against what they value, their content, but that some of it is also directed against how they value these contents. And of that formal part of his criticism of good, evil, morality, part is against the way good and evil polarizes or bifurcates the world. So when Nietzsche offers his own valuations of things as healthy or sick, as strong or weak, as high or low, I'm going to sum these as simply good and bad, he presumably means those contrasts not as opposite values. So I think we can take it that the sense in which Nietzsche denies that values are opposite is a key to the sense in which he rejects value dualism, hence to the way he's a value monist. So, just what does Nietzsche mean by his denial of opposite values? It seems a natural and obvious distinction in Nietzsche's voice, but what does it really consist in? What is it to have one's values as opposites? In what sense are good and evil meant as opposites, but Nietzsche's own values of good and bad, not? Now, not surprisingly, analysis shows, I think, that Nietzsche means a variety of things in his critiques of opposite values, in the various passages in which he treats this theme. I want to try to organize some of this variety. I'm going to arrange it from weakest to strongest, starting with the more obvious and ordinary things he means, and building to the more radical and difficult. These weaker points, I think, are, as it were, the steps by which he tries to help us and himself up to the ultimate lesson. And when we get to the most radical sense, we will have arrived back at the strong value monism I surveyed before, and I'm then going to return to the question how Nietzsche can consistently or coherently hold it. Now, before proceeding to this catalog, though, I need to make a few background orienting points. I want to set to the side a couple of special issues that cut against the grain of the senses that I'll distinguish. So, first background point. These senses that I'll distinguish of having opposite values, a value dualism, are all ways of thinking about one's values. They're matters of the status one attributes to them. Now, it might be argued against this that having opposite values is really for Nietzsche not a matter of how you think, or as it were, cognize your values, but a matter of the emotive force with which you hold them. So, in the resenter's no, there's a special intensity of animosity towards his enemies. And this strength or shape of feeling might be thought to be the really crucial element in the judgment evil. Nietzsche does indeed emphasize this difference in feeling, that the strong, the birds of prey, as he once memorably puts it, are a lot more favorably disposed towards those they judge bad, the lambs, than the latter are towards them. But I think Nietzsche clearly believes that this emotive force is fueled and justified by certain beliefs about the status of one's values. Good and evil are meant, are thought, to be values of a particular kind, not just felt with a certain intensity or from certain ulterior motives. And Nietzsche's own way of altering the feeling is by altering those beliefs. The senses of having opposite values I'll distinguish, okay, second background point. The senses of having opposite values that I'll distinguish are all meant as general points about how any values are held. So I'm taking them as not directed against and limited to particular value contents. Now, sometimes we'll see when we look at the passages that Nietzsche's complaint is not against having opposite values per se, but against valuing certain particular things as opposites, viewing, you know, certain things as having opposite value. It sometimes then seems to be more a critique of the good-evil opposition as it is widely held today, that these particular things called evil are in fact better, more valuable than those called good. So aggressiveness or suffering were taken as evil, but are in fact valuable. And the Dionysian embraces these in particular, it might be thought, but not other things. So Will to Power 1041, it is part of this Dionysian state to perceive not merely the necessity of those sides of existence hitherto denied, but their desirability, and not their desirability merely in relation to the sides hitherto affirmed, perhaps as a complement or precondition, but for their own sake, as the more powerful, more fruitful, truer sides of existence in which its will finds clearer expression. So note the evil side while disvaluing the good side, and that seems to open an opposite kind of dualism. And that's in fact the way that particular passage goes on. Since Nietzsche very often makes his point against opposite values with respect to good and evil, we have to consider whether he really would apply the point to his own values. Would he also say of the things he calls bad, or sick, or weak, or herd-like, that they are also good? My claim is that he does, that he denies that dualism, he denies dualism and affirms a kind of monism also with respect to his own values. So my suggestion is that we need to separate out from his attacks on the evil, the good-evil dichotomy, those elements that are directed against or only valid given its content, the particular traits it calls good. And the problem of value dualism is the question whether it turns out to be mostly a matter of content, so that Nietzsche's own values are just about as dualistic as the good-evil values. So in the following, I'm going to presume that Nietzsche also means to deny that his good and bad are opposite values, that his arguments against opposite values militate against taking good and bad so as well. Okay. I want to proceed now to the things that Nietzsche might, and sometimes does, I think, mean by his attack on having opposite values. So the first and weakest suggestion is this. Values, good and bad, don't originate in, aren't somehow grounded in, different ontological realms. So good, in particular, doesn't issue from an immaterial substance, such as a free and rational soul. Sometimes the oppositeness of dualistic values seems to lie just in the claim these values are grounded in such a being, dualism. So Nietzsche often makes the point that good actions must be explained by the same naturalistic principles that apply to the bad. In particular, the same aggressive and sensual bodily drives that have long been blamed for bad behavior are also the ultimate source of even our most altruistic and saintly acts. Will to Power 375, quote, "All the drives and powers that morality praises seem to me to be essentially the same as those it defames and rejects." That is, or e.g., justice as will to power, will to truth as a tool of the will to power. And Will to Power 272, quote, "My purpose to demonstrate the absolute homogeneity of all events and the application of moral distinctions as occasioned by perspective, to demonstrate how everything praised as moral is identical in essence with everything immoral and was made possible, as in every development of morality, with immoral means and for immoral ends." Similarly, he stresses how good and evil traits morph into one another. Here I have another Heraclitus passage for comparison. Heraclitus says, "The same, living and dead, and waking and sleeping, and young and old, for these transposed are those, and those transposed again are these." So on this reading, this first reading, value dualism is defined by its metaphysical postulation of another world. Nietzsche here cleaves to a literal sense of metaphysics beyond nature. It's postulating something apart from nature, life. So this passage from Genealogy of Morality. The idea we are fighting about here is the valuation of our life on the part of the ascetic priest. He relates our life together with that to which it belongs, nature, world, the entire sphere of becoming and of transitoriness, to an entirely different kind of existence, which it opposes and excludes, unless perhaps it were to turn against itself, to negate itself. So understood, Nietzsche's critique of value dualism would be straightforward. There is no such other world, no separate kind of cause. Will to Power 786, one has invented an antithesis to the motivating forces and believes one has described another kind of force. One has imagined a primum mobile that does not exist at all. According to the valuation that evolved the antithesis, moral and immoral in general, one has to say there are only immoral intentions and actions. Later, altruistic actions are only a species of egoistic actions. So here the value dualism, here the being monism is used to refute value dualism, understanding the latter as by definition positing being dualism. Elsewhere, however, I think it's clear that Nietzsche doesn't just reduce value dualism to this view that hangs on being dualism. Although being dualism is often used to support value dualism, he thinks the value dualism has an independent motive and an independent identity than this reference to an otherworldly source. Second thing, the second somewhat stronger thing that the denial of opposite values might mean. Values, good, bad, are never instantiated purely or completely. To put the point abstractly, no X is ever fully good or fully bad. But of course, there are many different ways of understanding this, depending first on how we understand what replaces X in the claim as Nietzsche means it. So first, does the point apply to types of entities, or does it apply to particulars? Is it, for example, suffering as a kind of human experience that Nietzsche claims is not fully bad, but also good? In this case, Nietzsche's point might be that there are some cases in which suffering is good, and he would allow it to be possible that in other cases it is just bad. Okay, so that would be to treat what it is that is never fully good or fully bad as a type of property. Or is it rather that suffering in each instance, as undergone by a particular organism in some particular situation, is always good as well as bad? Now, I encourage you to look at Nietzsche's arguments here. Many of them, I think, support only the former claim, for example, the argument that suffering is essential for growth or creativity seems to apply only to particular kinds of suffering of particular people. But the latter view, the claim that suffering in each case is always good as well as bad, that is obviously a much stronger view and much more difficult to argue or accept. Does Nietzsche think that even the bodily suffering of those quite unable to overcome it and to grow through it is also good? Nevertheless, although harder to accept, it seems to me that Nietzsche does hold this stronger view, at least in these sort of transcendent moments in which he is a universal yes-sayer. Okay, second question that comes up about this, this way of understanding the denial of opposite values. What is the range or level of entities that the X applies to when Nietzsche says that no X is ever fully good or bad? Is it that no person is ever thoroughly good or bad? That would leave it open that some particular acts by a person could be thoroughly good or thoroughly bad. Or does the point apply also to particular acts, such as acting from pity, or experiences, such as a suffering, a particular suffering? Again, it seems to me, if you look at Nietzsche's arguments, I think you'll see that many of them apply only to the weaker point But it seems to me he is trying to drive us, steer us towards the stronger point. He wants the stronger point. He, it seems to me, wants to deny value purity all the way down. Okay, now, why, and then I'm going to actually skip over, I mean, there's a further number of distinctions about, to try to examine what that value purity might, how it might be understood, you know, whether it's a matter of, or how the denial of the value purity might be understood, whether it's a matter of that everything has parts that are good as well as parts that are bad, or whether it's a matter of having aspects that are good and aspects that are bad, or whether it's a matter of having effects that are good as well as effects that are bad. If, there are various ways, it seems to me, that the argument gets put by him. And I'm going to skip over this complexity. Why does Nietzsche think, or how does he argue, that there is no pure good or bad? Leaving out a perspectivist argument, I think there are two main reasons. First is, an entity, a person, a drive, an act, is never completely good or bad because each depends practically on being the other in some way. So, Will to Power 351 says against the, what he calls the hemiplegia of the good man, who separates off one side of various dualisms and insists on just it. Quote, one is good on condition one also knows how to be evil. One is evil because otherwise one would not understand how to be good. Whence then comes the sickness and ideological unnaturalness that rejects this doubleness, that teaches that it is a higher thing to be efficient on only one side? Whence comes the hemiplegia of virtue, the invention of the good man? This unnaturalness corresponds then to that dualistic conception of a merely good and a merely evil creature. Okay, so the idea is that, as a practically speaking, you can only be good if you also have bad traits, and you can only be bad if you also are good in certain ways. You can only be a good thief if you're bad. Yeah, right. Well, you can only be bad as a thief. Not sure just how to put that. Let me skip that over. Okay, second kind of argument I think he gives. Nothing, no person, driver, act, is ever completely good or bad because it inevitably has opposite effects on different organisms or people. Due to the immense differences in the different people and actions, say, effects, it will inevitably further some but inhibit others. Okay. Now, although Nietzsche does hold all of these points, I think you would find, I think you recognize all of these as arguments that he makes in various places, makes all of these points rejecting value purity, I think this still isn't the gist of his point. And I think we should suspect this when we see how easy it is to agree with most of these claims. We'll readily admit that nobody's perfect. Perhaps we'll also be happy to apply this even to particular acts or experiences. Isn't there always at least some tinge of the negative in any action? Perhaps we'll also agree that things' effects are multifarious and that some of them are good, some of them are bad in this way. This isn't very far from common sense. It seems quite consistent with rather ordinary ambition to analyze and sum up the manifold goods and bads of a person or an act and so arrive at judgments about its overall goodness or badness. It doesn't change, as it were, the logic of good and bad themselves, but only the conception of how they're distributed in the world. They're distributed intermittently, as it were, not concentrated or pure. So I want to go on now to more radical claims, a claim about the logic of good and bad, rather than about how they happen to show up in the world. So the third thing that he might mean by the denial of opposite values is that values, good and bad, are scalar or comparative rather than bifurcated or inherent. So the reasons that I talked about just now for thinking that good and bad must always be co-instantiated are causal reasons and some empirical reasons. But Nietzsche, I think, also has what you might call conceptual reasons, connecting good and bad by necessity. The simplest form of such an argument is to call something good requires that there be a bad it's contrasted with. So there's something incoherent about hoping for a world in which bad, the contrast case, is eliminated. Again, a quote from Heraclitus, "For humans to get all they want is not better. Disease makes health sweet and good, hunger, satiety, weariness, rest." Quote from Nietzsche, Will to Power 351, "It takes good and evil for realities that contradict one another, not as complementary value concepts, which would be the truth. It advises taking the side of the good. It desires that the good should renounce and oppose the evil down to its ultimate roots. It therewith actually denies life, which has in all its instincts both yes and no." Okay, but Nietzsche, I think, makes a stronger and more interesting point than this. Good requires bad, not just for contrast, but as an element in itself. Good is always an overcoming of a bad. And one way that Nietzsche argues this is with respect to suffering. And again, I refer to Bernard's book, develops this point, I think, very well. He says that suffering is valued for its own sake because it is metaphysically necessary for creativity as overcoming. Creativity is always an overcoming of suffering. More generally, it seems to me, we can find this logic in Nietzsche's idea of power as a matter of overcoming. Power is a growth that rises above something it leaves behind as bad. This can be another organism it incorporates, but more essentially, I think, it's the inferior earlier condition of itself. Power is precisely the transition from a bad to a good, and so depends on both elements. Hence, good and bad stand in an asymmetric relation, Nietzsche says. The latter is presupposed by, even contained within, former as what it overcomes, but bad doesn't in the same way contain good, is not a descent from a good. Nietzsche draws the lesson from this, applied not to good bad, but to pleasure pain, that they are therefore not opposites. This is Will to Power 699. Pain is something different from pleasure. I mean to say, it is not its opposite. For unpleasure, and this is now not quote, but a sort of summary, for unpleasure is an ingredient in pleasure, as we see from tickling and sex, which Nietzsche thinks are pleasures composed of, quote, a certain rhythmic succession of small unpleasurable stimuli, end quote. But pleasure is not simply contained within pain. Similarly, Zarathustra says that creating requires destroying, end quote. Thus does the highest evil belong to the highest good, but the latter is the creative. This idea is expressed, of course, in the way Nietzsche so commonly thinks of values in terms of a scale or ladder up which we aspire to ascend. Let's see, I think I'm going to have to skip some things here. Yes, I'm going to skip some things. And I'm going to go on to the fourth thing that Nietzsche might mean by the denial of opposite values. And that is, what I want to say is that Nietzsche goes an important step beyond this point that I just made, which is, I'm suggesting a kind of scalar point, there is a ladder of value, and that things have value by their relative positions in this ladder. Nietzsche goes an important step beyond this scalar point. He specifies the common value which all of these positions are degrees of. He specifies the common value as good. So he takes the opposite stance, we might say, from Schopenhauer, for whom all life is bad, and all, quote unquote, goods are merely lesser degrees of bad. So escape from willing is, as it were, a zero degree of bad for Schopenhauer, the best we can do. Now, I want to say that this is really what the yes saying convinced Nietzsche to, that the common value which there are all of these degrees of is good. To say yes to something is to judge it good. And saying yes to everything is to judge everything is good, is to place everything on a scale of values whose common character is that that common value is good. Now, so Will to Power 1035, God conceived as an emancipation from morality, taking into himself the whole fullness of life's antitheses, and in a divine torment, redeeming and justifying them, God as the beyond and above of the wretched loafer's morality of good and evil. So if Nietzsche's ultimate judgment of things is that they are good, it seems that when he calls them bad, this must be a kind of specification of their goodness. Their badness is their way of being good. Bad simply means less good at what the good do so well. The bad occupy the same scale as the good. By contrast, in the good-evil morality, the evil are not treated as less good. They don't have a common project with the good. It's not the case in that morality that their goodness is a way of being bad. According to Nietzsche, the goodness of things on the scale is not a way of being bad. Only the opposite holds. Now, of course, we should ask, what grounds does Nietzsche have for this? Why believe that all bad is a form of good? From God's eye point of view, why doesn't everything just become a location on this scale, at once both good to an extent and bad to an extent? Now, in the positivist period, I think Nietzsche accepts this lesson, so that from an ultimate viewpoint, there are, in a certain sense, no values. They're just positions on a certain scale. I have a quote here from Human All Too Human, 1107, which I'm not going to read. But in his later writings, he throws himself back into valuing. Valuing everything as good. Why does Nietzsche think this? Why does Nietzsche think that all of the values on this scale are good? His argument is ultimately the role that life plays in constituting all values. So there are values only by virtue of life. Value is only in life's valuing. Moreover, what life values as good is itself, more of itself. So life, as the transcendental condition of all values and as the built-in aim of all values, is the ultimate good. So what we can say from the broadest perspective, the perspective of life, is that life is good. Any distinctions we go on to make will speak of only one kind of life. This will find some life good and other life bad. So below the monist perspective of life itself, there's a value pluralism. There are different goods internally to the different perspectives. But from the transcendent point of view, as it were, of life itself, life is simply the good. And I suggest that this is a key feature of the good-bad values Nietzsche promotes in place of the good-evil morality. It operates with the orienting judgment that life itself, in general, and in every instance, is good. And Nietzsche's chief argument against the good-evil morality, or Christianity, or the ascetic ideal, is that it operates with, ultimately, the opposite judgment that life is bad. Now, there's still a question, why this universal yes doesn't collapse the scale of values altogether and lead to a blanket or monochrome affirmation? Can Nietzsche really reconcile, harmonize this universal yes to the idea of a comparative scale and its determination of one direction or relation as bad? How can we affirm universally yet still say no? How can bad be a degree of good? We know that Nietzsche is extremely ready to say no. His work is not a universal yes-saying. And in fact, he explicitly rejects a blanket affirmation in certain passages. I have a quotation from Zarathustra 3:11, which I won't read. So the question is, how can Nietzsche say yes to life, not just in the aggregate, but also in every individual, but also go on to say no, that is, disvalue, evaluate as bad so many things? How can he consistently disvalue anything? This is what I want to address in the last section, which I'm going to have to skate through very quickly. So my suggestion is that Nietzsche has two strategies for responding to this problem. The problem how he can at once affirm everything as good, yet on the other hand, make evaluative distinctions and say no to many particular things. Now, a first possible answer is this, that Nietzsche simply passes back and forth in these different passages between two perspectives. On the one hand, a transcendental perspective that sees life as ultimate value. Secondly, a perspective within life, his own perspective, that disvalues many kinds of life. So another passage from Heraclitus, a famous passage, I guess it's not supposed to be Heraclitus' own words, but an approximation. For God, all things are beautiful and no valuing. We occupy the transcendent perspective, but then we throw ourselves back into life and into the internal yes and no valuing required for living. I have passages to show that he does in fact think of that transcendent perspective as a perspective, and that he thinks of it, he sometimes describes it as a temporary perspective. So one way to accommodate the dualism is to say that the monism is offered from a God's eye, supra-perspectival position. The dualism is offered from within Nietzsche's personal view. But as it stands, I think we have to notice that this reading of Nietzsche performs a bifurcation of his position into two views that don't affect one another. The transcendental yes-saying approves of the within-life saying no, but it doesn't affect how we say no or what we say no to. So it is, in this respect at least, odious. It turns no wheel. The transcendental yes-saying doesn't affect the way in which we say no within life. Surely that can't be so. Nietzsche surely wants to improve the ways that we judge yes and no within life by virtue of that monist insight. I think there are resources to begin to answer that challenge already within the perspectival position itself. I have to really go fast here, but Nietzsche can say that even though the divine perspective can't determine within life any particular values for us, it can affect how we hold those values. It can demand that we hold them just as our values. That is, recognizing their perspectival status, recognizing their containment within a divine value in all of life. So we go back into differential valuing in a way that preserves, in a certain sense, that transcendental insight. In particular, we don't take values to come from some other world. We somehow hold in the back of our minds the recognition that these values are just ours, and that the values of others we oppose are also equally validly expressions of life and pro-life. So Zarathustra 3:11, but he has discovered himself who can say, this is my good and evil. And we might think by contrast that the key point in holding opposite values is the refusal to step into the other viewpoint, the rejection of it altogether. I think there's a lot in favor of this perspectivist, as it were, resolution of the tension that I'm trying to bring out. But I think Nietzsche often has a stronger position. Nietzsche often wants to draw from the transcendent affirmative perspective. He wants to draw not just, as it were, a way of having values, he wants to draw a particular value contents, conclusions about what we should value within life. And in order to get these value contents out of the value monism, Nietzsche needs to specify life as will to power. This lets him specify an ultimate point to life, an essential aim in its valuing. And this lets the monism deliver a value content that can then be used as a standard in evaluating particular cases of life. So now, particular values are not just my point of view, and the only virtue is not just recognizing that status. Now values can be judged by how well they serve life's ultimate end, which is power. Life as will to power can be graded by the goal of power. Does a particular organism wield power effectively? What degree of power does a particular organism achieve? So the individual, Nietzsche, is able to take the point of view of life and make differential values differential judgments on its behalf. So the last point that I have, and I'm sorry that I'm going over, the last point that I have is that Nietzsche, taking this stronger position, using this way of drawing out of the value monism, that God's eye perspective, particular valuative conclusions, he does this in a way which strongly reintroduces bifurcating values. He does this in a way, the suggestion is one could do it in such a way that one gets then simply the kind of scalar values that I was talking about before. But that's not how Nietzsche often, those are not, often Nietzsche extracts values from the value monism, which have this more bifurcating and dualist character. And that is expressed in this argumentative locale in Nietzsche's accusation that some life is anti-life. I think it's very telling that his arguments often take this form. This is where his dualist urge gets its place, closest to the heart, I think, of his system. He claims that not just that there are, some people who are stronger than others, relatively. He claims that some individuals are sick in the sense that they are directed contrary to the essential end of life. Moreover, he claims that some of people are so sick that they are actually anti-life. So the ascetic ideal is hostile to life. And this is, I think, the way in which he puts the, as it were, lesson that he extracts from the value monism when he is most, as it were, value dualist and bifurcating. So, for example, Ecce Homo 4:7, quote, Christianity is criminality par excellence, the crime against life. This, the only morality that has been taught so far, the morality of unselfing, demonstrates a will to the end. It negates life at the most basic level. I have a last section which was going to show how even this value dualism, which he sometimes extracts from the value monism, is itself reconciled or harmonized with the monism, but I think I'm going to skip that. I'm sorry that I've had to speed through the end of it. That's it.